Can you use some supplements to support the fasting benefits during the fast, or should you supplement only during the eating window?
That's a great question. It's one I get asked a lot. So I think that there are certainly things that can upregulate autophagy. I mean, berberine is a good example, or curcumin, specific types of medicinal mushrooms. And I'm not talking about the ones that are hallucinogenic. I'm talking about medicinal mushrooms like shaga, reishi, etc. I typically will say, when in doubt, leave it out. So if there's a concern that something's going to break a fast, then just have it in the feeding window. But every day I take specific supplements in an unfed state, and that's not breaking a fast, whether it's magnesium.
Hi, welcome back to the Inka Land podcast. I am Inka Land. I'm a psychologist with a master's specialization to neuropsychology. And the purpose of my podcast is to bring you new science and practice of health and well-being. So you'll love today's episode if you're into fasting, intermittent fasting, autophagy, longevity, and brain health. My guest is Cynthia Thurlow, the author of the book Intermittent Fasting Transformation, whose TEDx talk about this topic has over 14 million views. On top of that, over 350,000 people follow her educational content on Instagram. And she has an active YouTube channel on fasting and health. Cynthia is a nurse practitioner, a globally recognized expert in intermittent fasting and women's health. So I'm very hyped about today's episode for a few reasons. One is that the research in intermittent fasting has mainly been drawn from the populations that use both men and women, and then they put them together as one single group. And the insights that we get from research are usually generalized to apply into both genders. Whereas now we know that it's not that simple, because women's hormones affect how we should fast, when we should fast, and when we shouldn't fast. The second thing is that there is a lot that fasting actually does to our bodies. So for example, it can change how our bodies handle nutrients and how much electrolytes and salt, for example, we need from foods, and how much protein we need from food. So all of this is covered in today's episode. I personally love fasting, but I've also done a lot of mistakes with it. And therefore, I wanted to bring Cynthia in to kind of give some clarity for us. What are the safe ways to fast? Can we use supplements? Should we use supplements when we're fasting? When should we fast? When shouldn't we fast? How much protein do we need when we are fasting? Does milk sweeteners or coffee break a fast? And what are the benefits that we are actually getting when we are implementing intermittent fasting into our lives? So Cynthia covers, for example, the benefits for insulin sensitivity, so blood sugar regulation. For brain health, we cover brain health, BDNF, neuroplasticity. We cover weight management and how it can affect positively on blood markers. So I guess the take-home message is that fasting is so much more than just not eating for a certain period of time. So I'm positive that you'll find a lot of nuggets of wisdom in today's episode. But before we dive into the episode per se, I'd like to say how grateful I am having you here. You know, I'm dedicated to bringing you free content on health and well-being as much as I possibly can, and it would massively help me with this mission if you could, in iTunes or Spotify, in your favorite platform, follow the podcast and give it a 5-star rating, because this helps the podcast rank and be found by other people like you who are also on a journey for optimal health and well-being. Or of course, you can directly share this podcast with a friend who might find it useful and interesting. So I don't know about you, but I personally find it very heartwarming when my friends send me messages like, "Hey Inga, just wanted to share this with you because I thought this podcast or episode might resonate with you too." So it's kind of like getting those health memes from your friends in Instagram, but only better. Anyway, whether or not you do that, I'm very grateful that you're here, and I hope you enjoy today's episode. Cynthia, welcome to the interview.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. Super excited. I finished your book yesterday, and I've been fasting for maybe 5 years on and off. And I still found so much new relevant information, so many new ideas, so many things that I didn't know about fasting. And I was thinking we could start with your story. Like, why did you start fasting in the first place? What was your motivation for it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was in the throes of perimenopause. So this is the 10 to 15 years preceding menopause. And no one had prepared me for the fact that I was going to suddenly become weight loss resistant. I never had problems losing weight when I was younger, after having babies, none of that. And all of a sudden, much like I recall from many of my patients, they get into their early 40s and nothing that they used to do works. And so I came to intermittent fasting out of a genuine curiosity to see if it would be effective for weight loss resistance. And then I stayed for all the other benefits. And I always like to share with people that as a middle-aged person, I didn't immediately lose the weight, but I felt so much better. I had so much more clear cognition. I had so much more energy. I wasn't dealing with feeling like I was constantly prepping meals, because we have been conditioned in the United States that snacks and mini meals are the way to go. And yet we now acknowledge that's really terrible advice. So for me, very much just a personal interest. And then I started weaving it into a lot of the work that I was doing with patients. Those that were receptive to not eat 16 times a day really found that their fasting insulins got better, their fasting glucose got better, they got off some of their cholesterol medications. Many of them were able to get off of antihypertensives. And so for me, it was starting as a personal journey, and then it really bled into everything else that I was doing personally and professionally, and even got my husband to start doing it, many of my family members. And pretty consistently, people felt so much better that it just made an easy strategy to continue with.
Right. Yeah. I listened also to your TED talk that has now, I think, 14 million views. So pretty impressive. And you told it's fasting is like simple and free. What was the like the three main things?
It was like free and flexible are usually the two big things. And I think depending on, you know, whether or not you're male or female, you have to do things a little bit differently. I always say women's hormones make us unique, but they allow us to have a great deal of flexibility in terms of when we should fast in our cycle, when we shouldn't fast. And I think for a lot of individuals, helping them understand that this is not a new or novel concept. This is actually something that dates back to biblical times. It's just been forgotten amongst the myriad of processed food industries that convince us that we need to eat 24/7.
Right. So what is your current fasting protocol?
Really depends. I mean, I'm very much an intuitive faster. I'm coming off of Thanksgiving and probably like most people in the United States, probably ate more carbs than I do normally. So I don't think about fasting as punishment. So for me, I eat when I get hungry. And if it's a day I'm lifting, I will eat earlier. I will have more carbohydrates. If it's a day I'm more sedentary, which isn't all that often, but if I'm doing quite a bit of traveling, I'm sitting on an airplane, I'm not as physically active, that might be a day that I fast a little bit longer. But on average, I fast anywhere from 14 to 17 hours a day. But, you know, around the holidays, when you're around family and maybe you have a big breakfast and you don't eat lunch and then you just have a moderate sized dinner, I think one of the key principles of fasting that I think is so important is helping people understand, like, the rigidity that I see many people kind of embrace and espouse in the fasting world. I really like to remind people, intuitive fasting, when you get to a point where you understand what is true intrinsic hunger versus boredom versus emotional distress, a lot of the other motivating factors for people to eat. So I think for myself, the answer to your question is really being flexible with how physically active I am, how busy I am, how sedentary I am, plays a huge role in whether or not I'm fasting for a longer period of time or a shorter period of time. I no longer do really long fasts, and that's something that, you know, perhaps we can explore today. It has a great deal to do with the concern surrounding muscle mass and maintaining insulin sensitivity, especially with age. I did not know, because it's not something that they taught in our medical training, that we lose muscle mass as we get older. And so this is why I think is so important. Like, you're at the point in your life where you're at peak bone and muscle mass. I'm on another point in my life. And so for me, maintaining muscle mass, maintaining bone mass are critically important. And that's why the overfasting is a huge concern for me, and definitely why I don't do a lot of very long fasts.
Right. Yeah. I think that you raised an important point there, that fasting protocols and fasting may change, or the principle may change a little bit depending on the women's age and cycle. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I feel like there are many busy women out there, all age, and a lot of people are concerned about the hormonal impact on the fasting. So how can we fast in a way that's safe for us, and we are not like raising our cortisol and becoming stressed on the fasting affecting our cortisol, if that makes sense?
Very important question. I would say let's start with younger women. So we'll talk about women in their 20s and 30s who are still at their peak childbearing ages, you know, 35 and under. I'm very protective of younger women. I think that it's important for them to understand that even if they're choosing not to become a parent, if at that time or ever, their body is exquisitely attuned to nutrient depletion and timing of meals. And so there's a time in our menstrual cycle, so the follicular phase from day one when you start bleeding up until ovulation. And I'll just talk about it in the context of a woman with a pristine 28-day cycle. So someone who does not have PCOS or luteal phase defects. And from the time you start bleeding up until ovulation, you can get away with a bit more fasting in the context of how's your sleep? How are you managing your stress? If you're a very lean, very athletic female, I think a lot of fasting can be detrimental. I think that one of the things that not enough clinicians are talking about is that we need to think about a woman's menstrual cycle is as important a vital sign as blood pressure, pulse, respiratory rate, temperature, etc. And so if you are a young, lean, athletic female, you don't need to be fasting every day. I get concerned if women are doing these 16, 18, 20 hour fasts, if they're very lean. Do I think that a lean athletic woman could get by with a couple days a week of doing some fasting? Sure. But to be in that state where you're in this massive anabolic growth phase and to be restricting food, I get concerned about the net impact on reproductive health. So in the context of the follicular phase, when estrogen predominates, we are more insulin sensitive. We can get away with a bit more hormetic stress, something I know that your husband talks quite a bit about, understanding that that's when we are most stress resilient in our menstrual cycle versus after ovulation, when progesterone predominates, it's the luteal phase. You may have not as much energy. You may crave different types of food. You may not want to do such long fasts. And certainly the 5 to 7 days preceding your menstrual cycle, we don't want women to be doing a lot of fasting. Now, I'm not suggesting 12 hours of digestive rest doesn't benefit everyone. 12 hours of digestive rest, which means, you know, you might have 3 meals in 12 hours and then you fast for 12, or you have 12 hours of digestive rest, can benefit most, if not all of us. That's very different. But I will get messages from women almost on a daily basis saying it's 3 days before my menstrual cycle. Why am I struggling to get to 12 hours of not eating? And I have to remind them that physiologically with what's going on in the body, that's a time when your body might need a little bit more nutrients, maybe 150 more calories of carbohydrate to help with some of those hormonal conversions. So that is younger women, very sensitive to, are you lean and active? Are you insulin resistant? Are you a PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome person? That's the most common endocrine disorder actually in women, is polycystic ovarian syndrome, actually not thyroid disease, which is a common misconception, versus a 35 to 50 year old woman. So a woman in perimenopause. And this is when our bodies become a bit less stress resilient. So you have to get good quality sleep. You have to manage your stress. And that doesn't mean 5 minutes of meditation once a week. That actually means some type of a practice that allows you to have support of your autonomic nervous system. And most of us are in this, as you mentioned, we're busy women, we're type A, we're going all the time, we're never relaxing. Helping people understand we have two sides of the autonomic nervous system. We have the parasympathetic, which is this rest and repose side. We have the sympathetic side, which is, you know, fight, flight, or flee. And helping people understand that we have to have balance. Our body is always looking for balance. So middle-aged women, you've got to get good quality sleep. You need to manage your stress. Anti-inflammatory nutrition becomes a larger issue. Now, I'm not suggesting that every woman listening is necessarily sensitive to gluten or grains or dairy or sugar or alcohol, but I find most are. And so anti-inflammatory nutrition is important. The right types of exercise. You know, women get into their 40s and they think to themselves, if a little bit of exercise is good, more is better. And I have to remind them that sometimes doing some strength training with just walking, as an aside, and some flexibility work is going to be better for you than trying to do CrossFit or high intensity interval training every day of the week that you can get away with when you're a bit younger. So these women in perimenopause, it's kind of dialing in on the sleep, the stress, the exercise piece. And I think the same applies in terms of where they are in their menstrual cycles. The follicular phase, you can get away with a lot more hormetic stress versus the luteal phase. And the beautiful thing about menopausal women, provided that they are sleeping, so menopause is 12 months out of a menstrual cycle, provided that they are sleeping through the night and they're managing their stress, they don't have the confines of the degree of fluctuating sex hormones that they did when they were younger. So I think in many instances, men and menopausal women have the easiest time with intermittent fasting. Mm. Now, having said that, again, I'll go back to the same thing to say, if you're not sleeping through the night and your stress is out of control, you're going through a divorce, you lost your job, you have some type of stressful event, goodness knows all of us have lived through the last nearly 4 years of this pandemic, coming out of the pandemic, a lot of extra stress. If you can't dial in on those things, don't add more fuel to the fire. This is when I would caution people about fasting. But everyone can benefit from 12 hours of digestive rest, irrespective of gender or life stage. And I think that's a really important message. I think so many of us have really gotten away from understanding that our bodies are not designed to have food being consumed, you know, 16 or 17 hours out of the day. That is grossly detrimental to our metabolic health. And in many instances is contributing to why we're seeing such poor overall health and chronic disease, not just in the United States, but in most westernized countries.
Yeah. I actually loved your book for this specific reason, that you kind of bring up these points that no one really talks about, like, hey, maybe if you are young and you are lean, rethink fasting every day, or rethink fasting period, or work with a clinician, as well as if you are sick or if you have. One very important thing that I find is not talked enough is eating disorders. And like, if you have a past eating disorder and you have been obsessively monitoring your food, maybe fasting is not the safest. Or if you do it, you kind of need to be aware of the risks for that and work with someone, have like a little bit of guidance. So thank you for raising all of those points, because I think they're super important. And I've definitely done a lot of mistakes with fasting. Just recently, a few days ago, when I was on my late luteal, and I didn't plan to fast, but we just got a puppy. And I was like, all my attention went to the puppy in the morning walk and everything. And I'm just like, I'm just going to have my coffee. And I found myself around 3, 4 p.m. like so in a very, very like low mood and like so depleted, just because I didn't have breakfast and I just raised my cortisol even with coffee. And so it's like, fasting is amazing. I really do like fasting. But when you are a woman, you just need to kind of learn a little bit more about it. And your Instagram, your books, your videos are an amazing source for that. And I wanted to ask you, you told at the beginning that you went in for the weight loss and you stayed for the other benefits. So what are some of the little known benefits of fasting?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, they don't even understand that when we're in a state of fasting and we're improving our metabolic health, so our body is effectively able to utilize either stored carbohydrate as glycogen or stored fat as fatty acids. When our body is able to break into these stores of fat and utilize that as a source of energy, you have the ability to then lead to ketones, and ketones can diffuse across the blood-brain barrier. And so for me, one of the things that really stood out fairly quickly, because I got into ketosis pretty quickly, was, oh my gosh, the mental clarity. So right. For those of us who are busy entrepreneurs, you know, it's 10:30 in the morning, I have not yet eaten. And I actually like to do podcasting in a fasted state, because there's so much mental clarity. And so I think for a lot of people, it's understanding that physiologically, these ketones are a preferred fuel source for the brain and can provide a great deal of mental clarity as well as energy. So I know many people, depending on where they are in their cycle, if they're in their follicular phase, they'll say, gosh, I actually like to do fasted exercise in the context of I'm not overdoing it. But if I go to the gym early in the morning and I can lift and do strength training, I feel really good doing it then versus less likely if I eat a big meal, I'm not going to be quite as motivated to go to the gym. I also think about things like autophagy. So the scientific principle of this waste and recycling process that goes on when we are in an unfed state. And certainly the stage of life that I'm in, a lot of people are concerned about precancerous cells, cancer diagnoses, things like that. And helping people understand that by getting rid of disease, disordered organelles, mitochondria, you can lessen and buffer the likelihood that you have the potential to go on and create significant disease. So I think that's definitely probably one of the less appreciated aspects. I also think about just the biophysical markers. I mean, how many of my patients have said, I got off of blood pressure medicine or I got off of cholesterol lowering medicine because I've improved my insulin sensitivity. I'm no longer insulin resistant. And so just thinking about, you know, the lipid markers, the cholesterol, the fasting insulin, fasting glucose, improved biophysical markers, I think is huge, you know, and not just the kind of traditional lipid markers, but even some of the more advanced ones, you know, looking at ApoB, LP, little a. In some instances, improving insulin sensitivity can improve those as well. And then just lowering our risk for neurocognitive disorders. I think because I'm in the sandwich generation, I have teenagers and I have parents who are aging. I'm very focused on neurocognitive health. And so knowing that fasting can be one of many strategies that can lessen our likelihood of going on to develop type 3 diabetes, which is Alzheimer's, or even being more susceptible to things like Parkinson's. And then lastly, I would say another kind of less benefit of intermittent fasting is just a reduction in inflammation. So many people just assume that with age, it's common to get achy joints. It's common to feel like you have less energy. It's common to feel like you can't be as physically active. And with that buffering of inflammation by eating less often, and sometimes in many instances, removing the most inflammatory foods, the things that many people really like to binge on, you know, the gluten, the grains, the dairy, the alcohol, the sugar, in many instances, in conjunction with a bit of autophagy from fasting, that reduction in inflammation can be quite significant. Along with that digestive rest component, you know, people will say, I'm no longer bloated after I eat. I feel like my bowel movements are more regular. I feel like I have less bloating. I mean, those kinds of things can be significant quality of life metrics for a lot of individuals.
Right. Yeah. I think also this, as you said, the neurocognitive effects are quite big. And do you think that we can get a lot of these benefits even with this 12 hours fast, or do we need longer fasts for that?
I think based on all the research, autophagy, you need to do longer fasts. With that being said, are you still getting benefits if you're doing an 18-hour fast? Yes. Do I think 12 hours of digestive rest can be helpful for a lot of the things that we've talked about? Absolutely. And that's why I've kind of gotten to the point now where I just say nearly everyone, including the teenagers in this massive anabolic growth phase, benefit from not eating for 12 hours out of the day. And so I think when a lot of the focus of my work is really being honest with people about metabolic health and how poor metabolic health is fueling nearly every chronic disease state that we see, 12 hours of digestive rest is very, very important. Now, if you want to take things up a notch, if you want to do a 24-hour fast so that you're really upregulating autophagy, that's something certainly worth considering. And if you are weight loss resistant, diabetic, metabolic syndrome, you have plenty of stored energy to be able to do that, always in conjunction with having a conversation with your healthcare provider. I always feel like I have to kind of tuck that in there because for some people, they need to make adjustments and medications. But with the exception of the autophagy piece, yes, I think there's still quite a bit of benefits. I think for a lot of people, they're always chasing the autophagy piece. They'll say, well, do I get any at 18 hours? And I always say, we don't know with 100% certainty because we aren't measuring it in real time. But based on research, right around the 24-hour marks is where things really get upregulated. So if that's a great concern, and I have several friends who are breast cancer survivors, and for them, they incorporate a 24-hour fast at least once a week for that purpose to really ensure that they are supporting that process.
Right. Yeah. I think a lot of the research is also pointing out to the fact that if we can like boost the benefits, and I'm now talking mainly about the brain benefits. This is like one of my biggest interests. How can we increase BDNF, for example, brain derivative neurotrophic factor and brain growth factor to preserve, as you said, this cognitive health, that if we are just on a mild ketosis and we do some 6-10 minutes of aerobic exercise that really boosts the BDNF by a lot more than if we have eaten. So even if just like after a night of sleep, we go into mild ketosis in the morning or have a little bit elevated PHB, for example, ketone bodies, then we can boost the fasting benefits with doing a little bit of exercise. And I personally find this to be feel very good if I don't necessarily want to do a longer fast.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because the longer I've been fasting, the less interested I am in doing longer fasts. And so I like other ways to upregulate autophagy, whether it's high intensity interval training, strength training, using certain types of herbs, you know, things like ergogenic aids, like coffee, green tea, black tea. And I think that's important for people to understand, like, it's not just fasting is the only way that you're going to upregulate autophagy. I think that's a really important point to make, because frankly, I don't want to do 24-hour fasts. I think that's like many, many years behind me. I just have less interest, because in lean individuals, the concern is if you're doing a lot of fasting, especially at the stage of life I'm in, the concerns are losing muscle mass at the expense of more autophagy. And so that is, you know, finding this, you know, hormetic stress of where is the balance. And for each one of us, depending on where we are in life stage, that can be a little less fasting, a little more fasting, depending on what people's needs are.
Right. Can you use some supplements to support the fasting benefits during the fast, or should you supplement only during the eating window?
That's a great question. It's one I get asked a lot. So I think that there are certainly things that can upregulate autophagy. I mean, berberine is a good example, or curcumin, specific types of medicinal mushrooms. And I'm not talking about the ones that are hallucinogenic. I'm talking about medicinal mushrooms like shaga, reishi, etc. I typically will say, when in doubt, leave it out. So if there's a concern that something's going to break a fast, then just have it in the feeding window. But every day I take specific supplements in an unfed state, and that's not breaking a fast, whether it's magnesium or alpha GPC, which I love for brain health and cognition, or, you know, at the stage of life I'm in, I mean, I do take some hormones in the morning, for specific purposes. So I think that things like branched chain amino acids, essential amino acids, creatine, I generally suggest people take those in a feeding window, versus some of the things that we've already talked about that can actually support a fast. The berberine, depending on the individual's insulin sensitivity. Now, berberine has many effects, and I like berberine, but for a lot of people, if they are sensitive, if their gut is sensitive, because it has antimicrobial properties, for some people, it's not something they can take on a regular basis. My husband takes it every day in a fasted state, for specific purposes, but I think there's a trial and error, but I do think there's absolutely supplements you can take that will not break a fast per se. But the standard kind of mantra in my mind is, when in doubt, leave it out. Like, if you're really concerned about something, and certainly the things I mentioned, EAAs, BCAAs, creatine, I generally recommend taking them in a fed state.
Right. There is also, many people are asking about milk. Can I put milk in my morning coffee if I'm fasting? And another thing is, stevia or any form of non-nutritive sweetener. And you talk about cephalic phase insulin release. So can you talk a little bit about that? Maybe that brings some clarity into the stevia milk coffee thing.
Yeah. So there's a couple things before I mention what a cephalic phase insulin response is. It's important to talk about clean fasting versus dirty fasting. Now, if you're someone that's weight loss resistant, you're really struggling to hit your fasting goals, then this is where those little hacks or those little things, whether it's copious amounts of MCT oil, half a stick of butter, cream, milk, they can make a difference for some individuals. So let's talk about cephalic phase insulin response. So this is when just by putting things in our mouths, sometimes even smelling things can actually trigger release of insulin by the body because it assumes food is coming. Now, I think about my grandmother was the most amazing baker. And if I were in her kitchen and I were smelling a pie, even if I wasn't going to eat it, I'm probably secreting some insulin. I can get my mouth will start to water. In fact, I'm thinking about it. My mouth is watering. And that is this kind of Pavlovian impact of making our body ready to eat. So the question is, if we have a cephalic phase insulin response, can we consume milk and cream and butter? These are generally insulinemic foods, so it means that they will provoke an insulin response, even if they per se are not evoking a blood sugar rise. So if you're an individual that is insulin resistant, you're diabetic, you have poor metabolic health, that may be a differentiator for you. It may be better for you to have this in a fed state if it's something you really like. Or the other thing to consider is if you are struggling with weight loss resistance, adding copious amounts of fats, fats are the most calorically dense macronutrient. That might be something to consider, like really measure those portions and be diligent. Because what I see is when people put cream in their coffee, they just kind of put the cream in the coffee and they're not paying attention to whether it's one tablespoon or five, or the buttered coffee, the bulletproof coffee that is very popular here. Now, when we're looking at non-nutritive sweeteners, there was a study that was done in Cell, I believe last September, and it was comparing saccharin, stevia, sucralose, and aspartame, looking at mouse models initially, looking at oral glucose tolerance and trying to get a sense for what was going on in the gut microbiome. And what was interesting was, obviously, I don't think anyone uses saccharin. I mean, I think about that. We used to be in a product called Tab, which was a diet soda that my grandmother used to drink many years ago. But we see quite a bit of aspartame. We see quite a bit of sucralose. And what the study showed, and I'm happy to share it with you, was when it was looking at these indicators, within 28 days, there were changes in oral glucose tolerance tests. So they're not benign, is the point I'm trying to make. Stevia in small amounts, I think, is fine, especially if you are growing stevia or you are having a high quality aliquot of stevia. So sometimes you can get stevia from like Whole Foods or one of the better grocery stores that has been prepared in such a way that it's the intrinsic good qualities of stevia and it's not a highly processed variety. Like Truvia here in the United States, I think, is produced by Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. Coca-Cola, don't hate me. And so when we think about these things, it's always in the context of, are you weight loss resistant and have poor metabolic health? Is adding in these artificial sweeteners beneficial to you long-term? There's lots of varying opinions on this, but I think when we look at specifically chemically at aspartame and sucralose, those are two that I'm not a real fan of. I think people can do better with things like monk fruit or stevia. Do I recommend that people consume these in an unfed state? Typically not, because we're feeding that, if we're talking about a clean fast, we're really feeding that cephalic phase insulin response. Now, if I were to wear a CGM, it would make no difference of whether or not I had flavored electrolytes with stevia or not. But on a cellular level, my body thinks something sweet is coming. And so I think that for a lot of individuals, depending on where they are on their journey, stevia could be a part of being in an unfed state, but in the context of understanding that our bodies are very smart. And so when I talk about clean versus dirty fasting, helping people understand like what makes the most sense for them. I am a realist. I want to be really clear about that. I think it's important to meet people where they are. And so if I have someone that's eating a standard American diet with a lot of artificial everything, if what's going to get them to a point where they can fast effectively is doing a little bit of cream in a coffee, that's probably not a deal breaker as long as they're being cognizant of portions. But I do think it's helpful for people to understand there's ways to work around the bitterness of coffee, as an example. If that's something that someone who has a very unattuned palate to the bitterness, the polyphenol rich density of like green tea, black tea, bitter coffee, helping them understand like you can add some high quality salt. You can add some cinnamon. Those things will not break. Yep. Those things will not break your fast. But they can change that bitterness profile to make it more palatable, literally. And so I think that's an important distinguishing thing to make. Like polyphenol rich foods don't bother me, but I acknowledge that's not all that common. Like the average person has a palate that is very attuned for sweetness and they prefer it over bitterness. But understanding that there's intrinsic benefits, as you and I both know, of polyphenol rich foods. And so helping them understand like, how can we bridge the gap while we're working towards getting you to not consuming fatty coffees in an unfed state, not consuming things with stevia, monk fruit, et cetera, in an unfed state? Like, how can we bridge that gap? And that's where I think some of these sweeteners, per se, not the really what I think are detrimental ones, sucralose and NutraSweet, things like that, but helping them understand there's bridges to get them from point A to point B.
Right. Okay. The salt thing is totally new for me in coffee. I'm going to actually try that because I do love a little bit of stevia in my coffee. I do find it quite strong in flavor and it really helps me. I'm going to try the salt thing. And I want to talk actually more about salt. I wanted to ask you one question about like fasting mimicking versus clean fast versus dirty fast, as you said. So there is this concept of fasting mimicking where you can eat, I don't know, a nut bar in the morning and it's still called fasting. Do you believe in it? Do you believe there is benefits? What's your like view on this? Can we mimic fasting or is fasting just fasting, you know?
It's interesting. I mean, certainly Walter Longo, this is his area of expertise, mm-hmm. and I have great respect and reverence for him. I think for a lot of individuals, the concept of fasting is so daunting and so overwhelming that when we break down macronutrients, protein, fat, and carbohydrates, we know that fats have the most negligible impact on blood sugar response and blood glucose response. And so the basic premise is that if you keep the calories low and you're consuming largely very low calorie or higher fat food, that you're going to keep your blood sugar stable, therefore keeping yourself in a fasted state. I find it interesting. For full disclosure, Prolon is a podcast sponsor. So I want to be upfront about that and say that I do think that it can be a bridge for individuals that are really scared / frightened about going 12, 13, 14, 15 hours. You know, there are products that people can consume. I look at it as a bridge, again, you know, meeting people where they are. With that being said, I think it's a curiosity. Like for me, the first time I did a 24-hour fast with a product, which completely was not in alignment with where I would have been 5 years ago, I was like, okay, this is a different way of fasting. And that's the kind of reframe that I find for myself is that for some individuals, they really do need the ability to feel like they have some, whether it's a mental thing, like this mental nourishment, knowing they're keeping their blood sugar stable. So they're not getting, and I wore CGM when I did it. So I was able to kind of the power of the N of one, but I think that's different than traditional fasting modalities. And most of the longevity researchers, in my clinical opinion, they're also individuals that restrict protein, you know, wanting to keep that mTOR activation blunted, that protein, muscle protein synthesis blunted. And that's in opposition to a lot of what I believe are the most important things that help maintain our health as we get older. And one of those things is muscular health. And one of those things is also adequate protein intake. So I want to just be totally transparent and share that I do think, you know, a fasting mimicking diet is a curiosity. I mean, there is solid science behind it. It might not be for everyone, but I do think for certain individuals, it can be a bridge to longer fasts without the concerns around not eating. And I think there are many people that are genuinely fearful of not eating for a day. Like it is a terrifying idea of not eating. And part of it's kind of getting over that mental hurdle of understanding that, you know, we have plenty of stored food, even people that are thin. Even you and I, we have plenty of stored resources in our bodies. We will not starve over a 24-hour period of time. But I do think it can be a nice kind of adjunct for individuals that are looking to do longer fasts, but maybe are fearful about going 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 5 days without food.
Right. So what would you actually recommend if someone is concerned about losing muscle, let's say? So what would be, let's say, a proper amount of protein to make sure that you won't going into too much of a catabolism, and what is the time of consuming that protein for the best preserved muscle mass during fasting?
It's a fantastic question. So 1 gram per pound of ideal body weight is what we're looking for. So if you're 125 pounds as a female and you're at a healthy weight, it is 125 grams of protein a day. And so this is where I will speak out about not being a fan of OMAD as a sustained strategy. I think it's fine in sporadic utilization, but ensuring that you can break up your meals into 2 or 3 meals and you can get sufficient amounts of protein. Now, my teenagers who are obviously 16 and 18, they need much less protein in a meal to trigger something called muscle protein synthesis. They need a lot less. Like they might need 10 or 15 grams of protein. I need 30 at a minimum, and I generally have 50 to 60 in a meal. So over the course of a 24-hour period of time, that's what you're aiming for. Does it have to be perfect every day? Absolutely not. This is why I'm not a fan of prolonged fasting. And this is why I don't do any prolonged fasting, because the muscle I have, I don't want to lose. And so it's a combination of adequate protein intake, and obviously animal-based protein is going to be superior to plant. and it's also a lower carbohydrate threshold. So especially in middle age, carbohydrates become an issue for a lot of people. And it's not that you're anti-carb or everyone has to be ketogenic, but if you're not insulin sensitive, you do have to be mindful of your carbohydrate intake. Enough strength training, you know, enough putting your muscles under tension, 2 to 3 days a week. And you have to manage your stress. You mentioned cortisol, which is this very important hormone. But if you're not getting enough sleep, you can put yourself in this catabolic state where you're breaking down muscle. And it's very hard in middle age to build muscle if you are chronically stressed and not sleeping. So I think it's those four things. But the muscle protein synthesis piece is important for people to understand, 30 grams of protein per meal. So I find a lot of women in particular are under eating protein, like they might have 50 grams a day. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is an easy thing that we can fix. A lot of times it's readjusting macros. So, sitting down and having a steak or having a piece of chicken or having a piece of fish and just being diligent, not being afraid if you're in a restaurant to have two portions of protein. Like I was at a restaurant and I don't know what it is about fish proteins here in the United States, but more often than not, you get really tiny portions. And I was like, can I have a second piece of fish? Because this is probably 3 ounces and I definitely need more than that. Mm-hmm. And then understanding that there's also this leucine threshold, which, without going into too much extraneous details, helping people understand that it's important to have this leucine threshold that's met. So it helps to trigger that muscle protein synthesis. And if you're getting at least 30 grams of protein in your meals, you can check that box, but it's really over a 24-hour period of time. I've had people ask me recently, I've been told that if I have more than 30 or 40 grams of protein, it gets stored as fat. I've been told if I have 30 or 40 grams of protein, it won't get used properly. And I was like, that's actually not the case. There's also this thermic effect of food. So unlike carbohydrates and fats, just the actual digestion of protein will help burn more calories than you're consuming. So it's a really interesting dynamic that goes on with protein, but I think that it's a very important one. And this is why over the course of a month, you don't want to have 5 days out of the week that you're doing OMAD, because you will chronically undereat protein. And if you're chronically undereating protein, especially north of 40, sarcopenia is a real issue. It's muscle loss with aging. It's not a question of if, but when, and you want to do everything you can to work against it. So think about like the muscle in your body right now looks like a fillet. If I'm not diligently eating enough protein and lifting weights, my muscle will turn into a ribeye, which although delicious, we don't want all our muscles to turn into all this fat and marbling, but that is what happens. Our muscles can atrophy. You can become weaker. And this is important for people to understand, like this, as we get older, it is even more vitally important that we are mindful of the fact that with the aging process, and Dr. Gabrielle Lyon says, we're not overfed, we're under muscled, helping people understand that what fuels the obesity epidemic is really this under muscled population. And so muscle is this key currency of metabolic health. And that's a really important distinction.
Yeah, I think fasting became a lot more easier for me. And definitely, I feel more energetic and better mood when I actually have an additional protein shake or some sort of proteinous snack in the afternoon. So like having just only protein, pure protein in the afternoon, an additional 20-30 grams, it's so easy to get from just protein powder. I think that's the easiest, most simplest way to get that additional protein if you find it difficult to consume large amounts of, I don't know, meat or whatever during the day. But I love that point that you're making, that it's very important to make sure that we are actually not starting to cause too much muscle loss with the fasting. Because sometimes we just look at the scale and we're like, oh great, I'm losing weight, if that's your goal, but you don't know what weight you are actually losing. Is there anything else you think we need to be very careful of? Especially I would like to discuss a sodium water loss during fasting, because it affects to all of that.
Yeah, no. And I think electrolytes, obviously my background's in cardiology. Mm. So for me, talking about electrolytes is something I've done for the entire duration of my career. But helping people understand, like as an example, if you're in a fasted state and you are consuming a lower carbohydrate diet. Now, average amount of carbohydrates in the United States people consume is 200 to 300 grams a day, which is an astronomical amount, but that incorporates both sugar sweetened beverages and food. but let's say you cut it back by half. You have plenty of stored glycogen, which is stored sugar in your muscles. You have some in your liver. But if you are going lower carbohydrate, what that will do is actually fuel the release of stored glycogen. So you may notice you're urinating more. You're like, what is going on? I feel like I'm peeing all the time. And that is actually a byproduct of this water loss. And with water, we'll pull sodium. It'll pull other electrolytes, but in particular sodium. And this is why when you're fasting, it is so imperative to salt your food and consume electrolytes. And I don't care what brand you consume, but you definitely want to be cognizant of that. And it's not just the sodium, it's chloride, it's potassium, it's magnesium, all of these very important electrolytes that in many instances, because of our highly processed diets, we're not getting real high quality electrolytes. And we lose them through just every day. Like we sweat, we poop, we pee, we breathe, we lose electrolytes just doing that. But it will be accelerated in a fasted state. And certainly if you are, you know, lowering your carbohydrate threshold, you will have more serum loss of sodium, meaning you will urinate quite a bit of it out. So if you are new to fasting, new to being lower carb, and by this, I'm not saying ketogenic. I'm just saying if you go from 300 carbs a day to 100 or 150, you will definitely release some stored glycogen. You will also then find that you're, you know, maybe urinating more frequently. You may get crampy. This sometimes can be the, you know, they call it keto flu, which is really a misrepresentation of what's happening, but it's your body's response to being dehydrated, losing those electrolytes. Some people get crampy, some people get nauseous, some people get, you know, they have headaches, et cetera. And it's helping people understand that, you know, with fasting comes the electrolyte replacement. And doesn't necessarily have to be one in particular. You want a clean brand that doesn't have junky. There's a lot of junky sugars out there. Stevia or Monkfruit is going to be a better option. There's even some lots of unflavored varieties. I use a variety throughout the day, but sodium is important to talk about because at least here in the United States, sodium has been bastardized along with fat for a very long period of time, and helping people understand that we actually need salt in our diets, high quality salt. So don't be afraid to add a little bit of salt to your food. It could be an enormous flavor enhancer. And don't be afraid to utilize electrolytes in a fasting state as well.
Yeah. So if you do like, let's say this kind of standard or I would think most common 16-8 fast that many people know and try and do, how much would you drink more water? How much would you take electrolytes?
Well, so I'm gonna tell you what I do. But I have mild dysautonomia, which is a fancy way of saying that I have more electrolyte needs than the average person. So I usually will encourage people to start with trace minerals. You can use them in your water in a fasted state. They do not make your water taste terribly salty. You can add them to any beverage that you're consuming. You can put them in coffee, you can put them in tea, you can put them into water. And then when your feeding window opens up, this might be the time, you know, Elements of a great company. That's one that I talk a lot about. They have stevia sweetened as well as unsweetened options. And that is a balance of potassium, sodium, magnesium, chloride that can be very beneficial. Now, I usually say start slow. So if you have one packet in your feeding window and that works well for you, great. If you feel like you're a little headachy, you're still a little tired, maybe having two in a feeding window is completely reasonable. But I do think those other like trace minerals, things that you can add to your water are nice options as well. I think a bit of experimentation because there's no right or wrong answer. There are certainly people out there that can consume electrolytes all day long and they feel great. There are others that feel like they just want it in their feeding window and they have one packet and that meets their needs. If it tastes salty to you initially, dilute it with more water. That's always the go-to is to say, you know, if it really feels salty to you, just dilute it with more water and kind of go from there. And that seems to work really well.
Okay, thank you. That was great. Let me check what else do I have for you. Okay, so if you could leave the listeners like one piece of advice with successful intermittent fasting, what would that be?
I think the biggest thing is to be, I use this statement a lot, but to be flexible, because what might have worked for you 6 months ago or a year ago may not work for you now. I think it's important to give yourself grace and be kind. I think we as women are so hard on ourselves in particular that I see women that beat themselves up on a daily basis, whether it's they weren't able to fast as long as they wanted to, or they're not seeing results by virtue of scale numbers, you know, stepping on the scale, there's a number in their head that they want to magically appear. And if it doesn't appear, they're beating themselves up. I think that we have to have some very hard and fast conversations with ourselves. Like, are you meeting your macros? That's number one. Can you get your protein in your feeding window? That's very important. Are you sleeping? How are you managing your stress? Are you over-exercising? So, you know, the concept of hormetic stress is one that I think can't be overemphasized. And I think for a lot of women, when they get weight loss resistant or they start struggling with, you know, not seeing the scale shift fast enough, and I'll say, depending on the individual, they think everything's going to magically happen in a week. Sometimes it takes a bit longer. Just helping them understand, like, let's get really honest with ourselves. Are we really getting 8 hours a night of sleep, high quality sleep? Are we doing some strength training, or are we over-exercising? Are we not giving ourselves a rest day? Are we, you know, chronically stressed and we're in an unhappy relationship, or we're not happy in our job? And just understanding physiologically what's going on with our hormones that can impact our success or lack thereof. And just understand there can be times in our lives where fasting just doesn't work. If you are pregnant, breastfeeding, those are two times that I generally recommend women not be fasting. It's not a time to restrict calories when you're growing a human or feeding a human, especially if you're breastfeeding. You know, if someone in your family is sick and, you know, you're just struggling to get through a fasted state, there's nothing wrong with taking a break. So big message is be flexible, be kind to yourself, and understand that fasting can be a season in our lives. It might be that it worked well for a couple of years, and then you take a break and you go back to a wider feeding window. And then maybe a few months later, you're ready to go back to it. But it's not something that needs to be rigid. And unfortunately, a lot of people in the fasting space preach this rigidity, which I think concerns me greatly, especially for women. I mean, men and menopausal women can get away with a bit more. Certainly younger women and perimenopausal women have to be more careful.
Thank you. That was such a good advice. I'm a really big fan of this, like just making young women to understand that, I mean, you don't even have to lose weight when you're fasting, especially if you are fit. I mean, it can be that you use it for one day for mental clarity, or you just try things out and improve your blood sugar balance and insulin sensitivity and things like that. So very good point. Can you guide people to find your all the relevant pages when they want to learn more about you?
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah. So www.cynthiathurlow.com. You can get access to my podcast, Everyday Wellness. You can get access to the book, The Intermittent Fasting Transformation. I am active on YouTube, which I'm aggressively trying to grow my channel. I'm active on Instagram. I'm a little snarky on Twitter. And I do have a free Facebook group that is for men and women on Facebook called Intermittent Fasting Lifestyle /my name. It's an anti-drama zone. I'm kind of anti-drama. And so we do a really nice job of facilitating great conversation, getting resources. And I actually go in and answer questions a couple times a week, not my team. They just kind of facilitate conversation. But I do actually, I'm actually active in that group because I think it's a great way to get to know what people are interested in and what they would like to know more about.